Good morning. It's time to read from the Sioux City Journal for today, Saturday, July 25th, 2020. My name is John Reif, and I'll be the one reading these stories for you today. Here's a look at what we will be reading. We'll start with the weather and the mini editorial. Next, we'll move to the front page stories of local interest, followed by more stories on the inside pages. At the 20-minute mark, we'll read the opinion page and any letters to the editor. At the 30-minute mark, we'll look at the obituaries, followed by more stories, sports, and feature stories, along with Dear Abby. First, taking a look at the weather for today. Mostly sunny, breezy, and humid today. A high of 92 degrees and winds out of the south-southwest at 10 to 20 miles per hour. Partly cloudy tonight, a heavy thunderstorm late tonight. Winds out of the south at 7 to 14 miles an hour. A low tonight of 72 degrees. Then an afternoon thunderstorm or two on Sunday, a high tomorrow of 85 degrees, winds out of the west at 7 to 14 miles an hour. Sunday night's low of 60 degrees, then mostly sunny, quite pleasant on Monday, a high of 84 degrees, winds out of the north-northwest at 6 to 12 miles an hour. Monday night's low of 62 degrees, partly sunny on Tuesday, very nice in the afternoon, a high of 86 degrees for Tuesday. Tuesday's night's low of 64, and then Wednesday mostly cloudy and a high of 83 degrees on Wednesday. Taking a look at the mini editorial today by Dwayne Behrens of Sioux City, it reads as follows. In December of 2019, President Trump tweeted, quoting here, "In reality, they're not after me, they're after you. I'm just in the way," end quote. He is so right. Again, that by Dwayne Behrens of Sioux City. Taking a look at the front page story of local interest on the top, it's airport traffic rebounds. Sioux Gateway boardings up in June, but still below normal due to the virus. This by Mason Doctor and Dateline Sioux City. The number of people boarding planes at the Sioux Gateway Airport rebounded slightly in June after bottoming out dramatically in April and May due to the coronavirus pandemic. A total of 591 passengers boarded flights at the Sioux City Airport in June, a number well below average for that month, according to airport data. But last month's tally was considerably higher than the 261 people boarding planes in April, followed by 330 in May. By contrast, in April 2019, there were 3,917 boardings at the airport, while in May of that year, there were 4,501, and in June, there were 4,061. This April was a terrible month for the industry nationwide, with air travel at just 5% of normal levels. Traffic at the airport began to slump in the middle of March, just as the COVID-19 pandemic and associated lockdowns gripped the nation. In the months that followed, vacation plans were canceled and some passengers grew uneasy with the idea of sitting for hours in an airplane cabin with strangers. Sioux Gateway Director Mike Collett referred to March as a hybrid month because air travel remained at roughly normal levels until the middle of the month. During March, the airport recorded 1,941 enplanements. The low numbers are likely partly attributed to a sharp reduction in the number of flights at the airport this spring. During April, May, and June, American Airlines, the only carrier at the airport, offered only one flight a day to Chicago, half the normal level. This month, the airport resumed its pre-coronavirus daily flight schedule with two flights to Chicago and one to Dallas. It's hard to say what extent passenger traffic might recover in July or August, even with the added daily flights. August is typically a slower month for the airline, said Barbara Sloniker, Air Service Director at the airport and Executive Vice President of the Siouxland Chamber of Commerce and the Siouxland Initiative. Airlines and airports across the U.S. have been stricken since the outbreak began, with nearly all parties reporting shocking losses. This week, American posted a loss of more than $2 billion in the second quarter, while the balance sheets of Southwest Airlines showed a loss of $915 million. American's second quarter revenue slumped 86%, while Southwest reported an 83% decline in revenues. United Airlines tallied a $1.6 billion loss in the second quarter, burning through $40 million a day from April through June. United is among the airlines warning of furloughs later this year, having already parted ways with thousands of their workers. It's unclear how badly the aviation industry will be hit by the recent coronavirus outbreaks in the south and the western portion of the U.S., though Sloniker struck an optimistic note on the Sioux Gateway Airport's passenger traffic going forward. "They're saying that traffic is coming back, but kind of slowly," she said. "Obviously, customers have to feel comfortable, safe traveling." In the inset picture on page A5, it shows a worker exiting a jet bridge Tuesday while preparing an American Eagle flight for departure to Chicago at Sioux Gateway Airport in Sioux City. On the front page, it shows a passenger boarding an American Eagle flight to Chicago July 21st at Sioux Gateway Airport. The number of people boarding planes at the airport rebounded slightly in June after bottoming out dramatically in April and May, due largely to coronavirus fears. The next story from the front page, Sioux City requiring face coverings. The mandate applies to all city buildings. This also by Mason Doctor and Dateline Sioux City. Visitors and staff will be required to wear face coverings while inside Sioux City's City Hall and other city buildings beginning Wednesday. The mandate announced Friday is in response to the coronavirus pandemic. Facial coverings are thought to impede the spread of the novel coronavirus when in public spaces. City officials said the requirement will remain in place until further notice. In a statement Friday, the city also again addressed why a citywide mask mandate is not legally possible. The city's legal department is citing a June 23rd letter from the Iowa Attorney General's office affirming that mask requirements are the prerogative of Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds. Because Reynolds has a public health proclamation in effect, a local official can't implement requirements that conflict with the state rules, the governor said. The city does, however, have the legal authority to require face coverings in its own properties. Businesses likewise have the right to require face coverings inside their premises, and some major retailers like Walmart and Sam's Club have announced that shoppers will be asked to wear masks. Reynolds has resisted calls to issue a statewide mask mandate, even as governors in neighboring Minnesota and Illinois have begun requiring them. The mask issue has come up in other Iowa communities. On July 14th, after Muscatine's mayor issued a mask order, Reynolds said local officials need the governor's approval for such rules. The mayor of Iowa City this week issued his own mask mandate in defiance of the governor's position, though his authority to do so remains unclear. A number of Sioux Citians have asked the city to require face coverings citywide, despite the legal obstacles. Mayor Bob Scott said earlier this week that while he believes a mandate could help slow the spread of the virus, he would defer to the governor's authority. "It's a non-starter because the governor has already said you cannot," Scott told the Journal. Photos accompanying this article show a stock file photo of the clock tower downtown and pictures of both Reynolds and Mayor Bob Scott. The next front page story, educators drive into protest in-person school order. Hundreds of vehicles, many adorned with messages expressing support for teachers and students, made a short drive through Des Moines to the Iowa State Capitol on Friday afternoon to express opposition to the governor's mandate that all schools conduct at least half of core subject instruction on-site during the upcoming school year. Many Iowa educators are asking for the flexibility to employ more or even exclusive online learning until the new coronavirus pandemic is more under control. "I think parents and educators all across the state are very concerned about the reopening of our schools this fall in person," said Mike Baranek, president of the Iowa State Education Association, a union that represents thousands of educators across the state. "All of us want our students to be learning and growing this next school year. However, we want our workplaces to be safe and secure and healthy. And with the current guidelines that are established by the state, that does not ensure the safety of our students and the health of our students and our families." Iowa on Friday surpassed 41,000 confirmed cases of the coronavirus, and as of Friday afternoon, 823 Iowans had died of COVID-19, the disease caused by the virus. And the 7-day averages for COVID-19 related deaths hospitalizations, and new cases have been slowly increasing over the past month. Baranek said individual school districts should be free to decide how much in-person and how much online instruction to offer instead of being forced to adhere to a statewide mandate. There are so many nuances to the field of education that require contact in proximity that with the current pandemic that we're witnessing here all across the country as well as in Iowa, and the numbers continue to grow, our school districts need to be fully in charge of making the decision on what is the most appropriate thing for them, Baranek said. The American Academy of Pediatrics recently issued a report that strongly advocates that all policy considerations for the coming school year should start with a goal of having students physically present in school. The report cited evidence of negative impacts on students from the disruption of the previous school year this past spring, the potential for harmful social isolation, and scientific evidence that young children appear to be less likely to experience severe harm from the disease and less likely to become infected and to spread infection. A spokesman for Governor Kim Reynolds said the reopening of schools was a key part of the state's pandemic recovery efforts. Governor Reynolds believes getting Iowa students and teachers back to school safely is an important part of our state's COVID-19 recovery. Her proclamation helps implement the statute the legislature passed unanimously this summer and also gives flexibility and options for educators, schools, parents, and students, Reynolds spokesman Pat Garrett said in an emailed statement. At Friday's event, vehicles filled a pair of parking lots at Des Moines East High School, then traveled in a caravan roughly a mile to the state capitol. The event drew educators from all over the state. Ryan Haynes, a music teacher at Orange Elementary School in Waterloo, said he decided to participate in the rally because there was otherwise, quoting here, very little right now teachers can do to bring some awareness about how we're feeling about going back in August. Shows an inset picture on page A6 with the event's destination, the Iowa State Capitol in the background. Cars line up for a driving rally in Des Moines on Friday to express opposition to Governor Kim Reynolds' mandate that K-12 schools conduct at least half of core subject instruction in person during the upcoming school year. Moving now to page A3, property owners protest valuations. Dakota County officials hear 170 challenges. This Dateline Dakota City by Brett Hayworth. Roughly 170 Dakota County homeowners objected this summer to new residential property valuations, and a panel over 3 days this week weighed the challenges, reducing a few of them. Dakota County Auditor Joan Spencer said Friday marked the final of 3 days since July 13th that the Dakota County Board of Equalization, the entity that gives final oversight to how valuations are set, processed through the protests. The Equalization Board did 60 reviews over 3 hours on Friday, although few people showed up in person over the week, Spencer said. With ongoing community spread of the novel coronavirus in the county, where 1,850 people have tested positive for the virus, those who appeared had to wear face masks. Spencer said a prime area for complaints came from rural residents where land assessment valuations had not been adjusted for many years. She also gave the example of some lots that had been valued at $3,000 or $4,000 having new assessments that doubled or tripled. The new valuations are one factor that will be used to calculate local property taxes starting in the next budget year. The valuations came out in March, and Dakota County residents had from June 1st through the 30th to file protests. As in other years where Dakota County residents protested assessments, the Equalization Board agreed to hire some temporary third-party referees, quoting there, with experience in property appraisal to help process the protests. The Equalization Board is tasked with reviewing the protests via considering all statistics related to the challenge and recommendations of the referees, and ultimately deciding if a valuation should be changed. Such protests of assessments frequently happen annually in Dakota County. Back in 2016, some residential values rose by as much as 30%, while some dropped for an average rise of 60%. Spencer said about 200 residents protested assessments in 2019, compared to 900 a few years ago. Next story, lottery takes hit, but still meets budget. Sales, revenue, and prizes all dropped since last year. Iowa lottery ticket sales, revenue earned for the state, and prize money awarded to players all dropped during the past fiscal year, but the lottery still met its budget targets despite the coronavirus pandemic. Preliminary figures released Friday show the Iowa lottery generated about $81.5 million in proceeds to state causes from $372 million in sales during the 12 months that ended June 30th. Players collected about $236.3 million in prizes. The unaudited results will show that Westside Cedar Rapids Hy-Vee stores continue to be leaders in lottery ticket sales statewide. The Johnson Avenue Hy-Vee reported $911,523 in lottery sales, with the company's Wilson Avenue store recording lottery sales of $897,610. The Hy-Vee drugstore on 6th Avenue Southwest had the fifth highest sales at $775,258. Overall, the lottery paid out $24.3 million in commissions to retailers. Although the lottery met its budget targets, sales in fiscal 2020 decreased 4.8% from the previous year's total of $390.9 million. Revenue turned over to various state causes dropped 12.3%, and prizes to players decreased 2.3% from the previous year's total. Those numbers were largely impacted by two main factors: the COVID-19 pandemic and a relative lack of big jackpots in national lotto games, according to Iowa Lottery Chief Executive Matt Strawn. The largest lottery prize over the past 12 months was a $1 million Powerball payout to a Correctionville man and a $1 million Mega Millions prize paid to the Just Us group in Eldora. Large jackpots for Powerball and Mega Millions won more than $1.5 billion in October 2018, the largest jackpot in the game's history, attracted players. However, in fiscal 2020, both games' jackpots were repeatedly won with increased frequency and comparatively lower levels, $40 to $100 million. That in turn meant lower overall sales in both games. The COVID-19 emergency further impacted the lotto category, with lotto sales nationwide falling during the pandemic, lottery officials explained. Scratch ticket sales in Iowa, which have set annual records each year since fiscal 2015, did so again in fiscal 2020, totaling $262.4 million. That is an $11.8 million increase from the previous year. Strawn noted that scratch games long have been the Iowa Lottery's leading product category. In recent months, Iowans who suddenly had large amounts of time at home made scratch tickets part of their hard copy entertainment options. In general, the type of lottery product that sells best in a given year has a big impact on overall lottery results. In a year like fiscal 2020, when scratch tickets sold particularly well, lottery profits overall will likely be a smaller percentage of total sales simply because scratch games have a smaller profit margin. Sales in lotto games are largely jackpot driven and therefore often fluctuate greatly from year to year, while sales of scratch games, pull tab games, and instaplay games are more consistent over time. The lottery raised $2.5 million for the Iowa Veterans Trust Fund, bringing the amount raised since 2008 to $30 million. In fiscal 2020, the lottery raised funds for the first time for the new Public Safety Survivors Benefits Fund, which helps with insurance costs for the families of Iowa peace officers and firefighters who die on duty. Since the lottery started in 1985, its players have won more than $4.6 billion in prizes, while the lottery has raised more than $2 billion for state programs. Next, showing an inset graph of coronavirus cases in Siouxland, starting actually with the three state areas for Iowa. South Dakota currently has 8,200 coronavirus cases, Nebraska 24,174, and Iowa leading the three states at 41,283. Going by county, in South Dakota, Yankton County has 96 cases, Clay with 103, Union County with 171. In the Nebraska side, Cedar County has 20. A note with Cedar County, it says 8 deaths in the region that comprises Cedar, Dixon, Wayne, and Thurston counties. So Cedar and Dixon, Cedar has 20 counties, Dixon 50, or 20 cases, Dixon 58 cases, Wayne 36 cases, and 8 deaths between the three states. Thurston County has 196, also part of that group. Dakota County leading with 1,850 cases, 41 deaths. In Iowa, Lyon County has 84, Osceola at 74, Dickinson County has 352 cases and 4 deaths, Sioux County has 553 cases and 1 death, O'Brien 110 cases, 1 death, Clay with 163 and 1 death. Plymouth County has 404 cases and 6 deaths, Cherokee 94 cases, 1 death, Buena Vista has 1,771 cases and 12 deaths. Monona County has 85 cases, Crawford with 689 cases and 3 deaths, Ida County with just 27, Sac County with 76, and Woodbury County with 3,519 cases and 47 deaths. Take a look now at the opinion page, and we've got other voices from the Omaha World Herald today, and it is titled, Nebraska is Right to Protect Seniors from Financial Exploitation. A sobering uncertainty hovers over every adult Nebraskan. There's no guarantee that when we reach our elderly years, we'll be able to retain our full mental faculties or health and manage our personal finances properly. Some seniors fall victim to outrageous scams. Others are bilked by guardians in whom they place their trust. Vulnerable, too, are non-elderly residents coping with disabilities, mental health challenges, substance abuse problems, or other impairments. The Nebraska legislature this week gave final passage to a proposal that can help protect individuals from financial abuse. Under Legislative Bill 909, the state will allow financial institutions to put a 30-day hold on transactions reasonably deemed suspicious, including withdrawing or transferring money, changing the owner of an account, or changing beneficiaries. Financial institutions also can notify someone close to the customer, such as a known family member or friend, a co-signer on the customer's account, or a trustee. The state should tread carefully in encroaching on an individual's right to manage their money, of course, but the threat from scammers has grown so severe that government action is appropriate. At least 10 other states have passed similar laws. Quoting here, this is not a hypothetical situation, according to Teresa Haye, H-E-Y-E, speaking on behalf of the Nebraska Independent Community Bankers Association during a legislative hearing on the bill. This has been a reoccurring problem. Mark Quandall, director of the Nebraska Department of Banking and Finance, similarly described the concern and voiced support for the bill. Seniors are set to make up a growing portion of Nebraska's population. The state's population aged 65 and older has increased from 246,000 in 2010 to 324,000 now, heading toward 418,000 by 2030. This new financial legislation builds on action the legislature took in 2014 when it created the Public Guardian Program to help protect vulnerable Nebraskans against financial exploitation following an Omaha World Herald investigation. Among the examples of the World Herald found was a court-appointed guardian in Omaha who took at least $350,000 from several wards. Since 2014, the state has trained almost 5,000 court-appointed private guardians and helped more than 600 vulnerable Nebraskans. The state is right to take such steps to protect seniors. With its latest action, the legislature is building on its determination to keep Nebraskans safe from financial exploitation. Again, that's the other voices in the opinion section. That's from the Omaha World Herald. Okay, moving along to more local stories on page A3. Encounter Center presents Like a Woman. The Betty Strong Encounter Center will be hosting the film Like a Woman with director Gail Mooney beginning at 7:30 p.m. on Friday. This will be an event that will take place outside of the 900 Larson Park Roads Encounter Center. Guests are invited to bring their own lawn chair or blanket with the movie that starts at dusk. Mooney, who also wrote Like a Woman, described the movie as being an inspirational look at women who are breaking barriers in male-dominated professions. With film festivals either being canceled or postponed, Mooney was afraid Like a Woman wouldn't be seen by a wide audience. That's when she decided to take the film on the road, doing grassroots screening under the stars in a socially distanced way. Mooney travels around the country in a small camper van with her film, a digital projector, a screen, and a small sound system for gatherings of 25 people or less. For more information on this or any other Encounter Center program, you can go to SiouxCityLCIC.com. That's SiouxCityLCIC.com. Next, Alley Art Festival will return. Alley Art Festival will return for a second year in downtown Sioux City in 2 months. Vanguard Arts, in collaboration with Downtown Partners, on Friday announced the return of Alley Art Festival from 1 p.m. to 11 p.m. on September 26th. This street art festival gives local artists with a platform to demonstrate their skills by creating murals in alleyways. Those will be located between 4th, 5th, Pierce, and Nebraska streets like last year. Plus, it is expanded to also include 4th Street between Pierce and Nebraska streets as a spot to browse and purchase art from local vendors. Organizers will monitor the COVID-19 pandemic and will be taking precaution in hosting Alley Art Festival. The Alley Art Festival was created to reinvent urban spaces with art and is part of an ongoing effort to enhance walkability between the historic 4th and historic Pearl districts. Last year, more than 20 artists took part. Alley Arts Festival was the brainchild of Vanguard Arts owner Brent Stockton. "We are excited to host the second annual Alley Art Festival. We had an overwhelming response last year," Stockton said. Admission is $5 at the gate. Food and beverage vendors will be present, and live music will be included. Next story, Mapleton man pleads not guilty. A Mapleton, Iowa man who has had a homemade bomb in his car has pleaded not guilty to threatening to kill his wife in downtown Sioux City. Christopher Moyle, 41, entered his plea Thursday in Woodbury County District Court to charges of explosive permit violation, possession of explosive or incendiary materials or devices, domestic abuse, assault, and first-degree harassment. Moyle is accused of texting his wife a picture of her car parked outside the Woodbury County Courthouse, where she was getting a protection order against him on July 6th, and threatened to shoot her. Moyle continued to send her text messages telling her it would be a bloodbath in which she would be the first target if she sent police to stop him. After police officers approached him, Moyle ran away and jumped in Perry Creek in an attempt to escape. Officers followed him into the water and took him into custody. According to court documents, officers searching Moyle's car found a severed deer head, an AR-15-style rifle containing 22 live rounds, two magazines full of ammunition, and a homemade bomb containing gunpowder, wooden nails, BBs, and shotgun pellets. Next story, motorcyclist hospitalized after crash. A 30-year-old motorcycle driver was transported to Mercy One Siouxland Medical Center with potentially life-threatening injuries following a single-vehicle crash Thursday night. At 11 p.m. Thursday, Sioux City Police responded to a report of a crash that occurred on the 1400 block of North Lewis Boulevard. Investigators say the driver of a blue 2015 Honda motorcycle left the roadway, striking a utility pole. The driver was ejected from the motorcycle. The name of the injured person is not being released, and the incident remains under investigation. Two men arrested after break-in. Two Sioux City men were arrested following a burglary at a mid-city residence Thursday afternoon. At around 3:32 p.m., police were dispatched to a home on the 1600 block of Ingleside Avenue, where two males reportedly kicked in the back door. Both men gained entry, threatening to injure an adult male and female. Both suspects fled the scene on foot before being apprehended by police three blocks away. Trey Red Owl, 28, was charged with second-degree burglary, carrying a weapon, simple eluding, and possession of drug paraphernalia. Michael Thomas Jr., 28, also, was charged with second-degree burglary and simple eluding. All right, now it's time for the obituaries. Today, leading off from Sergeant Bluff, Maxine J. Wolverton, 90 years old, of Sergeant Bluff, passed away Tuesday, July 21st, at Pioneer Valley Living and Rehab in Sergeant Bluff. Private family graveside services will be held at a later date. Arrangements are under the direction of Rush Family Care Service in Onawa, Iowa. Condolences may be left online for the family at www.rushfamilycareservice.com. Maxine Jeanette was born on June 15, 1930, in Hadar, Nebraska, the daughter of Arnold and Stella Celine Freilich. She grew up in Norfolk, Nebraska. She attended and graduated from Norfolk High School. Maxine worked at an appliance store during high school. Maxine Jeanette Freilich and Gerald Robert Bob Wolverton were united in marriage on October 12, 1951. To this union, two children were born, Barb and Jim. Maxine and Bob's love for each other was truly a blessing. Bob recently said, "I'm thankful for the life she provided me." She was a homemaker and enjoyed raising her family. She worked at the Storm Lake, Iowa Buena Vista Regional Medical Center in the gift shop, and after her retirement, she volunteered there to see her many friends again. Maxine enjoyed making greeting cards, word searches, crafts, and crocheting afghans. Family was very important to her, especially her grandchildren and great-grandchildren. Maxine attended Community Church of Christ in Sloan. Next, Travis Lee Gutierrez, Sioux City. That's Travis Lee Gutierrez, 31 years old, of Sioux City, passed away Monday, July 13th. Memorial service will be July 27th at 6 p.m. at Meyer Brothers Colonial Chapel. Visitation will be July 27th from 4 to 6 p.m. at the funeral home. From Cherokee, Alma Jean Leonard, 89 years old, passed away Thursday, July 23rd. Service will be July 27th, 1 p.m. Arrangements are being done by Greenwood Schubert Funeral Home in Cherokee. Burial will be at Grandview Cemetery in Quimby. Visitation will be July 27th from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. at the funeral home. From Sioux City, Jesus Martinez, 65 years old, who passed away Thursday, July 23rd. Arrangements are being held by Waterbury Funeral Service of Sioux City. From North Sioux City, Larry D. Simple, 68 years old, passed away Wednesday, July 22nd. Service will not be held at this time. Arrangements will be done by Waterbury Funeral Service of Sergeant Bluff. From Sioux City, Jimmy Johnson Jr., 46 years old, passed away Friday, July 24th. Waterbury Funeral Service of Sioux City is also handling those arrangements. From Sioux City, Guses Narienes, that's G-U-S-E-S, last name N-A-R-E-I-N-E-Z, of Sioux City, 65 years old, passed away Thursday, July 23rd. Arrangements are being done by Waterbury Funeral Service of Sioux City. An important man in the history of this town, Irving F. Jensen Jr. of Sioux City. That's Irving Frederick Jensen Jr., 88 years old, of Sioux City, who passed away July 22nd at his home. Services will be 1 p.m. Monday at the Sioux City Orpheum Theater, mandatory mask requirement. Masks will be available at the door if needed. Virtual service will be available via orpheumlive.com. There will be a private family burial service. Arrangements are under the direction of Meyer Brothers Colonial Chapel. Irving was born on March 19, 1932 in Sioux City to Elizabeth Mary McFarland and Irving Frederick Jensen. His family members were longtime residents of Sioux City. His father and grandfather were associated with the Jensen Craig Construction Companies, as well as Irving F. Jensen Company Incorporated and many affiliated companies. Irving attended Bryant Elementary, North Junior High, and graduated from Central High School in January of 1950. He attended University of Nebraska for one semester and then finished his schooling by attending Yale University and graduated with a B.S. in Industrial Engineering in 1954. He was a member of the Phi Gamma Delta Social Fraternity. Irving was a member of the ROTC and became a second lieutenant in the U.S. Air Force, assigned to Lackland Air Force Base in June 1954 until November 14, 1956. He was a captain in the U.S. Air Force Reserves. He resigned his commission in 1965. He married Carolyn Tigger Bakens at the Beacons Home, No. 1 on 23rd Street in Sioux City, on November 1, 1954. They have four daughters, Mia Elizabeth, Juliana Sue, Carolyn Beacons, Nancy June, and one son, Irving Frederick III. He was proud of his children's successes and the grandchildren they raised. Irving was employed at Jensen and Craig from November 1956 until the beginning of 1958. He was employed by the Irving F. Jensen Partnership for 1 year. Irving was employed by Irving F. Jensen Company Incorporated from 1959 until 2006, when the company was sold to Knife River Corporation. The successes of the company were due to the close working relationship with a management team which consisted of Irving Jensen Jr., Colin Jensen, Eric Jensen, and Byron Brower. Mark Jensen and his overseeing of Enviro Energy in Minnesota was also part of the business success. Irving also shared a close relationship with his nephew, Cress Jensen, whom he mentored all his life. Irving was still involved with both Knife River and Jebro until the end, sharing many years of experience, wisdom, and ideas. Irving was a member of the Iowa AGC and the National AGC. He served on the Highway Committee for both the Iowa and National AGC, was a member of the Young President's Organization for 10 years, was president and served on the board for many years of the Iowa Concrete Paving Association. He served on the board and was president of the National Concrete Paving Association, located in Chicago, Illinois. Irving was an active volunteer as a board member of the Sioux City Chamber of Commerce, president of the board of Morningside College, board member of St. Luke's Hospital, board member of Marion Health Center, on the athletic committee of Morningside College, board member of the Sioux City Public Museum, board member of the Event Facilities Advisory Board, president and board member of the Sioux City Orpheum Theater, as well as giving a significant amount of time, money, and wisdom to the restoration of the Orpheum Theater. In addition, he was a board member of Toy National Bank, taught Public Works employee management courses on the Class Council of Yale Class of 1954, and heavily involved in the Yale football program. He was a member of the Yale University and Timothy Dwight College football teams and owner of the Timothy Dwight College snack bar. This was just the start of his life of management. He was a lifetime member of Our Savior's Lutheran Church, where he was a board member and served as an usher until the closure of the church. He then became a member of First Presbyterian Church. Irving enjoyed trips to Arizona and California in the wintertime with Tigger. In addition, they both enjoyed the antique and classic automobile car meets and caravans. He was able to go to Europe through the United States government and the Federal Highway Administration, FHWA, to learn new techniques on highway building led by the Secretary of Transportation. The delegation consisted of six paving contractors and six directors of the DOTS. It was an experience that he never forgot. Irving enjoyed Lake Okoboji from July 1933 until his very last days. It was one of his favorite places. His most loved and enjoyed times were those spent with his wife and family. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be directed to the Sioux City Orpheum Theater, Morningside College, or Hospice of Siouxland. That's it for obituaries for today. Moving on now to local sports. IHSAA adjusts football season. 7-game regular season, every team in the playoffs. This is by Justin Rust. While the IHSAA announced about a week ago that the 2020 fall season will happen, there was still uncertainty about how to proceed with a 9-game football schedule and how picking the playoff field will work. The IHSAA answered some of those questions on Friday when the association announced revised the 2020 football schedules, going from a 9-game regular season schedule to 7 games and allowing all teams into the playoffs in every class. Gone are the previous schedules for Class 4A teams, who now will find 7 opponents on their own. For Class 3A, 2A, 1A, and A teams, they get to keep their 5 district games, which will now shift from a Week 3 to Week 7. Those teams go from 4 non-district games to 2, and they will have to find those 2 games on their own. The 8-man previously announced schedules go from Week 3 to Week 9 to Week 1 through Week 7 instead. A 7-game regular season was announced, but teams do have the option of scheduling 5, 6, or 7 games. The IHSAA is requesting member schools let them know their intent to participate in the season by August 17th. The revised plan does not penalize teams with a loss or forfeit due to state, county, or local health department determinations due to COVID-19 situations. I think it's a good decision, Sergeant Bluff Luton coach Justin Smith said. Not punishing a team if they have to miss a couple of games in the middle of the year and not taking them out of playoff consideration is good. Moving the district games up and having teams schedule those first two games gives them the chance to schedule teams that are closer. You don't have to put 60 to 70 kids on a bus for one long ride now. The key dates to start the season remain unchanged. First practices are still scheduled for August 10th, and the first games of the season are planned for August 27th, 28th, and 30th. There may be two fewer regular season games in 2020, but Smith likes that his players will have a chance to play out the season. We talk so much about protecting those kids at risk, and I understand that. We also have young men and ladies that are responsible for their well-being and emotional health, Smith said. They've invested a lot of time into athletics, and if we can play in a safe way, that's great. Giving the kids the opportunity to play with people looking out for them is the right move. North head coach Mitch Moore liked his 2020 football schedule after it was released in the spring. He felt the changes the IHSAA made to the 4A schedules then gave the class a more competitive balance. So at first he was disappointed that schedule won't be played out in 2020. However, Moore quickly came around as to how he can form North's schedule now, at least for one season. That's the way it should be. I am a fan of what we have so far, Moore said. Everything in the area will be pretty simple to get done. Getting that sixth or seventh game will be a bit harder, but I don't think it will be a struggle. I think there are teams that will come here like Fort Dodge, which has the decision of going to Sioux City or Des Moines. However, the decision did take some coaches and athletic directors around the state by surprise, since there wasn't much of a warning that this would be announced on Friday. Not only is Larry Allen the head coach of OABCIG, the Class 2A state championship, which will play in 1A now, he's also the athletic director. I appreciate the fact the IHSAA is in favor of us playing. As coaches, we want to play, and we will do whatever we need to do, Allen said. It puts everyone in a bad position when you have to find those two games. It's one of those deals that would have been nice to have a heads up on things. We are all in the same boat and scrambling to keep games you had or find new games. If someone drops you, you have to find another, and that's been the problem for everyone. One of the annual non-district games for OABCIG is against Ridgeview, which is a rivalry contest. Allen thinks he will be able to keep that game and is looking for his second non-district contest. I understand the reasoning from the IHSAA. If a team gets into a situation due to non-contest, that it doesn't cost the whole season and they can still make the playoffs, Allen said. It just caught everybody off guard. Moore said Friday has been a, quoting here, wildfire. Still, he thinks he has seven games lined up. They just have to be approved by the school board. One of the soft games Moore scheduled is at South Sioux to open the season, which was on the original schedule on the same date. If that's a great game for us, and that is a great game for us and is local. If we get to keep them and Nebraska lets us keep them, it makes it a lot easier, Moore said. Having it on week one was huge for us. If it was in the middle of the season, who knows? I think we will be okay with that one. With East, West, Heland, that fills the schedule up nicely. Smith is looking to fill his two non-district games with a couple of city schools, but if not, there are a few 3A teams in the area for the Warriors to play, such as Lewis Central or Harlan. Other protocols have yet to be announced, such as the playoff seedings. The RPI will not be used this year to determine seeding since all teams qualify for the postseason. However, the format is a 64-team bracket, but there are less than 64 teams in each class. There were 61 teams in 3A last season, the most of any class. So there will be probably first-round byes to determine along with the seeding. It's a good plan and well thought out plan when you aren't getting punished. Football is the only one in the state where you have to earn your spot except for this year, and this is a solid option, Smith said. The format did seem vague. They said geography and quality, if they go on record the past 5 years, who knows? There's not going to be a perfect system. I think they're doing their best to give the opportunity to kids, and there are going to be some bumps in the road. I think we're extremely excited to give the kids a chance to play. Going back to the front page of the sports section, breaking the ice, Kingsley Pearson upsets number one Class 1A seed. This is by Zach James, Dateline Des Moines. All the Kingsley Pearson High School baseball team needed to do was break the ice. The Panthers didn't score until the sixth inning, but once the Panthers put a run on the board, they used that momentum to beat the top-seeded Martindale St. Mary's 3-2 in eight innings on Friday in the Class 1A quarterfinals at Principal Park. Kingsley Pearson, 16-2, was playing its first state tournament game since 2002. The Panthers will play Don Bosco and Gilbertville in the semifinals on Thursday. It's nice to come out here and beat the top seed when no one was expecting it, especially in the comeback fashion that we did today, Panthers senior Damon Bowman said. The Panthers scored two runs in the sixth inning and added on the go-ahead run in the eighth inning. Both runs in that inning came with two outs. Connor Bielner set off the rally by reaching base on an error. Then Bowman and Emerson Pratt each had hits in the sixth inning. Pratt's single scored Bielner, and after that, the Panthers could take a deep breath of relief. They were on the board. The Panthers then tied the game at 2-2 in the sixth inning on Friday with an RBI single from Malachi Christofferson, who was 2-for-5 in the win. Christofferson's single was a line drive to left field, and once the play ended, the Panthers sophomore pumped his fists in excitement while his teammates congratulated him with waves and fist bumps. Then in the eighth inning, the Panthers didn't waste time taking the lead in extra innings as Matt Cookie Christofferson drove in the go-ahead run on a sacrifice fly. The inning started with Bowman flying out to center field, but freshman Bew Boobke, who came in to pitch in the seventh inning, started the rally with a walk. Since Boobke was the pitcher, Panthers coach Taylor Dishcott used senior Jonah Walden as the courtesy runner. Malachi Christofferson got an infield single, which moved Walden to second base. Walden advanced to third base on a wild pitch and later scored on Matt Christofferson's sacrifice fly to right field. Dishcott knew coming into the game against the Blue Devils, who were 26-2, that the lineup could produce hits. "My message all year was to keep pressure on the opponent," Dishcott said. "That's been our philosophy all year, and we're going to stick with it." Earlier in the game, that rang to be true for Kingsley Pearson. The Panthers loaded the bases twice, both in the second and third innings. In the second inning, Bowman and Pratt led off the inning with singles. Matt Christofferson drew a one-out walk, but the Blue Devils starting pitcher Isaac Gavin got Damon Schmidt to strike out with a full count. Then in the third, Gavin walked Bowman to load the bases, but again got out of it with a strikeout to Emerson Pratt. In the first five innings, the Panthers had five hits and four walks. "We had confidence the whole time," Bowman said. "We knew we had to get focused. We had to get up to the plate with confidence. Throughout the game, we got more and more confidence. It paid off for us." "We don't come up scared to face anyone," Bowman added. "We come up ready to bat. We know we have to get our foot down and drive the pitch." The Blue Devils struck first in the second inning with their only two runs. Cole Cassidy knocked in a run with a single to right field that advanced to second base due to a misplay in right field by Pratt. Cassidy later scored on an error from catcher Bo Harvey as Harvey tried to catch Cassidy stealing third. Harvey's throw went high, and that allowed Blue Devils' base runner to score. The Panthers committed four errors by the time the third inning came around. Dishcott wasn't surprised that there were nerves, but he was hoping early the Panthers would work through it. Dishcott admitted that he might have been a little hard on the guys, but realized this isn't just a game at Kingsley's baseball field, it's a state tournament game. "It can be overwhelming for a team that hasn't been here in a long time," Dishcott said. "There's a lot of stuff going on. I expect them to be perfect, but I know they're high school kids. I thought after the second inning we got our nerves out and we really settled in. Hats off to the guys, they stayed in it and they stayed positive." The pitching and defense also helped the Panthers settle down midway through the game. Evan Newman started the game for the Panthers, and he went 4 1/3 innings. Newman allowed two runs, neither were earned, on two hits. He walked three and struck out three. Matt Christofferson and Schmidt held the Blue Devils scoreless through the fifth and sixth innings. When the seventh inning came around, Boobke was the fourth pitcher that Dishcott used in the game, but it nearly didn't happen. Earlier Friday morning, Dishcott filled out his lineup card for the media, and he forgot to insert Boobke, Dishcott's nephew, on the card. Dishcott realized his gaffe before the umpire's meeting, and Boobke was a late add-on to the official coach's card handed to the umpire right before the game. "We needed him," Dishcott said. "He's going to be a kid that will have a lot of varsity success. He commands a good strike zone, and he's got good off-speed. He's cool under pressure." Boobke took the mound in the seventh inning, replacing Schmidt. Schmidt allowed a walk and a single, and that put runners at the corners for the Blue Devils. Bubke came in and forced two flyouts and a groundout, but he did load the bases with two outs with a walk. I couldn't really think, Bubke said. We were playing in the moment. I have all my confidence in my infield. I visualize all those situations every night. In the seventh inning, Bubke struck out the first two batters he faced and allowed a single to Carson Elbert, MSTM's number two hitter. The game ended when Harvey caught Elbert attempting to steal second base. Once second base umpire Keith Wohlers of Council Bluffs called the play as an out, Kingsley Pearson stormed the field full of celebration. I'm just happy I could pull through for my seniors, Bubke said. They deserve it. It shows two pictures on the front page of the sports section. One is showing Kingsley Pearson's Bo Harvey tagging out Martinsdale St. Mary's Cole Cassidy at home plate during the Class 1A quarterfinals at Principal Park Friday in Des Moines. The other shows Kingsley Pearson players reacting after the Panthers beat Martinsdale St. Mary's during the Class 1A quarterfinals at Principal Park Friday in Des Moines. Time now for Dear Abby. The first letter today by Fed Up in California, it's titled, Girlfriend of 13 Years Can't Get Stepmom's Attention. Dear Abby, I live with my significant other. We have been together for 13 years now. I would like to ask his stepmother why she refuses to acknowledge me. She sends holiday cards addressed only to her stepson. I am left off invitations as if I simply do not exist. Should I confront her and tell her it hurts my feelings? I have had a couple of visits with her, and I'm respectful. She has introduced me as, quoting, a friend of her stepson. I feel it's time to speak up. Do you agree? Signed, Fed Up in California. Dear Fed Up, I am surprised that after all this time, your partner hasn't spoken to his stepmother about this. I agree it is time to bring this out into the open, but only if you can curb your resentment and talk calmly with her. Tell her her omissions have been hurtful and ask why she seems incapable of acknowledging your relationship with her stepson. Once you have put her on the spot, listen to what she has to say, but resist the urge to strike out. If you can manage that, you will not only have learned something important about her, but you will also have kept your dignity. Next letter is from Trying to Cope in the South. Dear Abby, people often stress out over the stuff that goes on in daily life and don't seem to know how to deal with it. Frankly, I don't know either because I stress out more than most of the people I know. Do you have any advice on some things I can do to stress less? Signed, Trying to Cope in the South. Dear Trying to Cope, several things come to mind. Make it your business to get out of the house and walk every day for at least 30 minutes. I find it has helped me to put things into perspective. Look online for some simple meditations and breathing exercises, which can also help to relax you. If you drink, do so only in moderation. Remember, alcohol can be a depressive and make you feel tired and down. When you are feeling overwhelmed, recite the Serenity Prayer. Grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, and courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. And if your stress continues, don't suffer in silence. Discuss it with close friends and family, and if necessary, your doctor. One more letter from Call Me Ma'am in Florida. Dear Abby, when I was a girl, then a young lady, next a mother, and now a grandmother, I was never a guy until the last 10 years when waitstaff and salespersons began calling me that when I am with my husband. Examples, how are you guys tonight? And what can I get you guys? I am not, nor have I ever been, a guy. Other than baring my breasts, how do I let people know that I am not a guy and wish to be addressed otherwise? Signed, Call Me Ma'am in Florida. Dear Call Me, the servers and sales staff are not intending this as a personal affront. Using the word guys to refer to a group, a couple or group, is becoming so common that it's now in the Webster's Dictionary. However, this is a complaint voiced by many of my readers of a certain age, along with not enjoying being addressed as sweetie or young lady. If it bothered me as much as it does you, I would quietly take it up with a manager or supervisor and suggest that because it is annoying, sir and ma'am would be a more suitable substitute for you guys. You might also prefer to dine in a less casual restaurant or shop in a more exclusive store to see if you are addressed differently. One last look at the weather. Hot and humid today, a high of 92 degrees with mostly sunny skies, a little breezy south-southwest winds at 10 to 20 miles per hour. Tonight, partly cloudy, a heavy thunderstorm late tonight, a low of 72 degrees and winds out of the south at 7 to 14 miles per hour. For Sunday, an afternoon thunderstorm or two, a high of 85 degrees, winds west at 7 to 14. A low Sunday night of 60 degrees. On Monday, mostly sunny and pleasant, a high of 84 degrees. Monday night's low of 62. Tuesday, partly sunny, nice in the afternoon, a high of 86 degrees. Tuesday night's low of 64. And Wednesday, mostly cloudy and a high of 83. And that does it for the reading of the Sioux City Journal for today, Saturday, July 25th, 2020. For the last, most of the hour, the stories have been read and selected by me, John Reef. All material heard on Iris is intended solely for the use of the blind and print handicapped. If you have any questions, call Iris toll-free at 800-404-4700. And we want to thank you for listening to Iris, your radio reading service.